This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 8, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. The New York State Senate considers a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. In Africa, Somali refugees continue to flood into northern Kenya. And clashes between policemen and indigenous people in the Peruvian Amazon have left at least 40 people dead. We'll bring you the latest on this story and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The results of the European Union parliamentary elections are in, and despite an expensive campaign encouraging Europeans to vote, it was the lowest turnout ever. From London, Naomi Fowler.
Far-right and extremist parties have gained seats at the expense of the centre-left across the European Union. The apparent voter boycott of the elections raises serious questions about the political legitimacy of the entire European Union project, just when EU powers are about to increase dramatically when a controversial treaty is about to come into effect. It also leaves questions for the left about why they've failed to benefit from the failures of free market capitalism. In the UK, Gordon Brown's Labour Party received only 16% of votes, its lowest share for nearly a century. It came in third after the anti-European Union UK Independence Party. The racist British National Party won two seats for the first time. The scandal over MPs' abuse of their expenses has been key. Labour MP Andy Burnham.
I think there was a politics at the lowest ebb that I could ever remember in my time in Parliament. And it's not surprising, therefore, that these elections we are seeing people expressing their dissatisfaction with all of the mainstream political parties, and understandably so.
Gordon Brown is under increasing pressure to call a general election and to honour a promise he made to allow a referendum on whether the UK should stay in or get out of the European Union. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
The US Supreme Court announced today that it will not consider a challenge to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the military policy that bars openly gay individuals from military service. The High Court let stand a decision that holds the current policy is rational. In so doing, the court has allowed the Justice Department to avoid arguing in support of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a policy that President Obama said in the past he would move to repeal. Also at the court today, justices said that judges who are elected to the bench must recuse themselves when major matters involving campaign donors come before them. The case was filed by Hugh Caperton, the owner of a small coal company in West Virginia, against A.T. Massey Coal. After an original $50 million judgment in Caperton's favor, Massey Coal donated $3 million to the campaign coffers of a West Virginia Supreme Court judge who later swung a vote overturning the award. Brian Wolfman is the director of Public Citizen Litigation Group.
If the decision had come out the other way, it would be open season for the kind of campaign contributions for big companies to make in pending judicial elections when that company or its principals, the people who ran those companies, had an interest in litigation pending before a court.
Wolfman says today's decision upheld the constitutional right to have a judge who is not essentially bought by a litigant. In Indian-administered Kashmir, police fired on demonstrators today in the town of Shopian, leaving dozens injured. Protests continued despite emergency measures declared by Indian authorities after the rape and alleged murder of two women. Shanawaz Khan reports.
An unofficial curfew was imposed today in Shopian, and some roads were closed to restrict free movement of people throughout the Kashmir Valley today. These measures were taken to block a march to the town of Shopian that had been called by Kashmir separatists. It has been a week of shutdown throughout Indian administered Kashmir, with protests and heavy restrictions after the government initially termed the death of the two women accidental and ruled out rape. Local residents insisted the two were raped and murdered and accused Indian security forces of the act. Anger against the government rose up when it ruled out rape. Residents who had talked to autopsy doctors contested the government's claim, and a forensic report has now verified rape. One man has died and hundreds of others injured in the week-long demonstrations. Police have arrested top separatist Saeed Ali Gilani, who called for the week-long shutdown and protests. Other separatists have also been either arrested or put under house arrest. Shanawaz Khan for Free Speech Radio News, Srinagar.
Two American journalists who were convicted in North Korea of an unidentified grave crime against the North Korean nation were sentenced today to 12 years of reform through labor. Yuna Lee and Laura Ling were arrested in March near the Chinese border while on assignment for Current TV. The State Department says it is ready to use all diplomatic channels to negotiate their release. Fresh on the heels of his trip to the Middle East last week, President Barack Obama praised yesterday's parliamentary elections in Lebanon. Pro-Western politicians from the ruling government coalition beat the Hezbollah-led opposition, securing a U.S.-supported alliance in the parliament. Jackson Allers is in Beirut.
President Obama issued a statement this morning praising Lebanon for conducting what was a peaceful elections process yesterday. The U.S.-backed government coalition, the so-called March 14th coalition, won 70 out of 129 seats in parliament. The Shia Muslim party Hezbollah won 11 seats in all of the races in which they fielded candidates, but their Christian allies, led by former Lebanese Army General Michel Aoun, were losers in key districts of North Lebanon. Although the U.S. will have a more Western-friendly government in the Lebanese parliament now that March 14th has won, Hezbollah's presence will force the U.S. to at least indirectly deal with an organization it considers a terrorist group. Chief among the concerns with Hezbollah is their sizable arsenal of weapons, with which the U.S. and its allies will have to contend for a long time to come. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
Thousands of ethnic Karen villagers have fled into Thailand after government forces in Myanmar, also known as Burma, launched an offensive against Karen fighters last week. A Thai army spokesperson said at least 1,700 people displaced by the fighting have crossed the border. Humanitarian groups place the number closer to 4,000. The Karen National Union has been fighting for independence for some six decades. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Friday's deadly clashes over territory and resources in the Peruvian Amazon have triggered international condemnation. Peruvian police killed at least 30 indigenous people who were protesting new oil and gas projects that they say destroy ancestral lands. Protesters say that a recent free trade deal between the U.S. and Peru paved the way for these developments, and they retaliated to the police attacks by killing 22 officers. Tanya Snyder reports from a human rights protest in Washington.
The FDA has got to go! Hey, hey!
Dozens of people gathered outside the Peruvian embassy in Washington, D.C. Monday to draw attention to what they call a massacre of indigenous activists. The activists had been protesting in the Peruvian Amazon for more than 50 days, blocking rivers and roads near the town of Bagua to keep out equipment that's used for mining and oil and gas extraction. Andrew Miller runs campaigns for Amazon Watch, a nonprofit working to protect human rights and the environment in the Amazon region. Miller spoke at the protest outside the embassy.
Ultimately, indigenous people must have the right to say what is going to happen on their territories, in their lands. And they must have a say in what is the development model that is happening in their areas. These cannot be models simply imposed on them as they have been imposed for hundreds of years.
Peruvian President Alan Garcia sent in police to disperse the protesters and clear the roads. Early Friday morning, police arrived while many protesters were sleeping. According to eyewitness accounts, when the protesters refused to leave, the police fired tear gas grenades from helicopters and shot into the crowd. Amazon Watch's Gregor McLennan went to Peru the day after the killings to gather testimony from those that were there. He heard audio recordings taken during the clashes between police and protesters.
You can hear the policemen there shouting, "Yeah, shoot at the head, shoot at the head, shoot him dead," as the protesters were running away into the mountains. The police seem to have had orders to use force in order to clear the road. The police seem to be acting on the kind of false information that this is kind of some kind of armed terrorist group. There was never any violence. There was never any vandalism occurred. All that was happening was people were closing down roads.
Protesters did retaliate, however, reportedly killing 22 officers with machetes, spears, and the officers' own guns. For himself, President Garcia has been accused of human rights violations in the past. He was president in the late 80s, during the Shining Path guerrillas' anti-government rebellion. Garcia tried to defeat the guerrillas militarily, allegedly ordering several massacres which led to the deaths of an estimated 1,600 people. Peruvian artist and blogger Carlos Quiroz has been living in Washington for 13 years. He attended the embassy protest against what he calls Garcia's racism and brutality.
El negocio es vender esas tierras, dársela a los petroleros.
His business is selling those lands, giving them away to the oil companies, to the investors, who are bleeding Peru dry. These events are demonstrating that the people are ready to defend their lands with their lives. I've come to be part of this protest against Garcia because he's willing to sell Peru piece by piece, starting with the Amazon, which is the most precious land in the entire world.
President Garcia has accused the indigenous people of trying to stop progress. He says while the lands where extractive industries want to operate may be the indigenous people's ancestral lands, the richness of the subsoil belongs to all the Peruvian people. But according to Amazon Watch, about 70% of the Peruvian Amazon has been concessioned to oil and gas companies over the last 5 years. Peruvian artist Rodolfo Marzo says that's not the way to benefit the Peruvian people.
After it was signed, the president of Peru, Alan Garcia, was given special power to issue decrees, and he issued about 102 decrees, many of them against the Constitution and against the ILO 169 convention, which requires prior informed consent of indigenous people before things are done to impact what that will impact their lives.
The free trade agreement between the U.S. and Peru went into effect in February and escalated the extractive activities in the region, as well as the protests against them. Tom Loudon coordinates the Alliance for Responsible Trade. He says Garcia responded to pressure from the United States, and the indigenous people have been protesting ever since. The activists in Peru and the U.S. are demanding an independent investigation into Friday's killings. They say the estimate of 30 indigenous deaths may be far too low. They accuse the police of dumping bodies into rivers and burning them to hide the true numbers of deaths. More demonstrations against the Peruvian government's use of force will be happening across the U.S. and around the world this week. Indigenous activists in Colombia are reportedly planning a demonstration for later this week in Bogotá. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
A month-long offensive launched by hardline insurgents against Somalia's central government and its supporters has displaced an estimated 100,000 people. Meanwhile, camps for refugees and the internally displaced are struggling to meet the needs of the new arrivals. The Dadaab camp in northern Kenya, for example, was designed to house 90,000 refugees when it was built in 1991, but it's now home to 275,000 people. This makes the camp a public health time bomb, according to Donna Canali, a San Francisco nurse who volunteers for Doctors Without Borders. Canali returned from a four-month mission in northern Kenya last week, and she spoke to FSRN's Catherine Comp.
Can you talk about these conditions a little bit more? What are some of the concerns? Food and water shortages, health concerns. Why is it so? Why is the state so miserable there?
The camps were built for 90,000 people. They're severely overcrowded. It was 272,000 people, and the infrastructure and the resources have not kept up. They've stayed basically the same, so there's no way they can meet the needs of these people. It's generally very, very hot there, 115 degrees or more, and sandy, so you know, people need protection from the heat. But also, as soon as it rains, it floods. So then you have a big sanitation problem. There are not nearly enough latrines.
You've mentioned a little bit some of the mental health issues. Many people coming from these conflict zones where they've dealt with a lot of terrible things, but then also sort of living in this place and not knowing if they're ever going to be able to return home or live in a more normalized situation. How do you deal with that? And does it affect how much of the population at the camp does it affect?
Some of the stories we hear are pretty hard to believe, although we know that they're true. For instance, let me just tell you one short story about this family who escaped from Somalia. They were caught in the fighting. Their family was severely affected. This mother managed to leave with a daughter and four of her other children. Her daughter was pregnant. Her oldest daughter was pregnant with her second child at the time. They managed to get out. They got to the camp. They have a very small shelter set up for them, not large enough for everyone to fit inside. And the daughter, shortly after giving birth, this young woman said, "I can't take it here anymore." And she left. And she left her mother with her two small children and went back to Somalia. Conditions for her in the camp were so traumatic, she needed to leave. It's not unusual to run across abandoned children. That parents are either they've disappeared, we don't know where they are, or they've left, they've just gone back. And the generosity of other refugees to take these kids in, even though they don't have any additional resources to care for them, is pretty amazing.
When you came back to the States, you met with UN and U.S. government officials. What did you talk to them about, and did you get commitments from anyone to help improve the conditions either at this camp or for the Somali refugee crisis in general?
You know, Kenya, these camps here are one of the very few refuges that people have from Somalia to escape the violence. There's some things that are needed right now. The camps are horribly overcrowded, so land is needed. The UN agencies and the Kenyan authorities, they need to find a way to expand these camps because this is a direct threat to the health and the well-being of the refugee population and therefore the host community around that population. And what you have there are a lot of idle young people sitting in a camp in despair. Something needs to be done about that.
That was Doctors Without Borders field coordinator Donna Canali speaking with FSRN's Catherine Comp. Proponents of low-power FM won a crucial court case in their battle to secure space on the dial for hyper-local radio stations. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Radio station KRYS in Spokane, Washington, broadcast its first program in 2003. The low-power radio station is one of several hundred in the U.S., which means it can be heard less than 10 kilometers from the transmitter. Program director Angela Johnson says KYRS is the voice for the voiceless.
We are the only station that has a Spanish language program. We are the only station with a children's youth program, with a Persian culture show. Our music variety is just across the board. Local artists get full representation on KYRS, whereas they can't get airtime on other stations.
KRYS was threatened by radio dial encroachment. That means a full-power radio station wanted their spot on the dial, or a frequency so close that the large station's broadcast would interfere with the low-power station's signal. But the Federal Communications Commission said KYRS and other low-power stations have protections against large, powerful broadcasters. The big broadcasters objected and filed a lawsuit. The U.S. District Court of Appeals ruled Friday in favor of low-power FM. That was big news for Angela Johnson.
It's really good for LPFM. It basically gives them a little sense of security.
Sakura Saunders is with the Prometheus Radio Project, which works on behalf of low-power FM stations. She says high-power stations no longer have full reign over the radio dial.
Full-power stations, when they move, they have to consider the existence of low-power radio stations. And if they're going to kick the, you know, low-power radio station off the air, well, then there's options for the low-power radio station.
Those options allow low-power FM to receive a waiver, allowing them to broadcast on the second adjacency, two clicks on the dial away from a full-power station. Although the FCC and now the courts have carved out protections for low-power FM, advocates want to go further. They're turning to Congress to ensure low-power radio stations have a spot on the radio dial. And on Capitol Hill, momentum appears to be favoring low-power radio as well. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Same-sex marriage bill in New York has already passed the state assembly with the support of Governor David Patterson. But with Democrats holding only a slim majority in the state Senate, the question of marriage equality is coming down to a handful of key lawmakers, with LGBT activists mounting a major lobbying effort. FSRN's Ari Paul reports.
Brendan Fay of New York City wants his 6-year-old civil marriage trail project to become irrelevant. In 2003, after marrying his same-sex partner in Canada, he founded the group with other activists to assist gay and lesbian couples in New York to travel to Canada and later to Massachusetts and Connecticut to get married. Under current New York law, those marriages are recognized, but a bill allowing such marriages to be conducted in the state is before the state Senate. Fay believes it's not enough for New York citizens to be able to take a trip to get married.
The people who are most hurt by the current situation are those who are too ill, too frail, perhaps too disabled, to be able to make that journey by bus or by train to Stamford or Toronto. Or maybe those who are too poor or can't afford to take the time off.
Senate Majority Leader Malcolm Smith won't bring the issue to a vote until he can woo as few as 5 dissident party members to support the bill. With the current Senate session set to close this month, same-sex marriage supporters are talking to lawmakers about gay marriage as a civil and human rights issue. For years, advocates have argued that so-called civil unions are separate but unequal compromises that offer few of the legal benefits of marriage. Fay, an Irish immigrant, said that the issue of immigration is often overlooked in the gay marriage debate.
Most people, when you sit down and ask, well, why marriage? What are some of the legal rights? The legal rights cover everything from hospital visitation to taxation, adoption, tenancy laws. I'm an activist. I've been arrested. Even access to one's spouse and partner in prison. These are all thousands of legal rights and responsibilities that come with marriage. One of the benefits of that marriage at New York City Hall for my straight brothers and sisters is the right to a green card. They immediately get in track for legalization for immigrant purposes. And yet, as a gay man, I am denied that right.
Fay and other activists recently met with Senator George Orinato from the borough of Queens, who has remained neutral on the issue. Father Lewis Braxton, an Episcopal minister who runs a shelter for queer youth, said the meeting was productive.
I was impressed that the senator, while he wasn't jumping up and down expressing his support, he was open to the idea, and so I'm hoping that it will pass.
But then there's State Senator Ruben Diaz of the Bronx. He's a Pentecostal minister and a conservative Democrat who is one of the party members holding up the vote. He opposes gay marriage on religious grounds, but shifts the blame on the lack of marriage equality onto New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Senator Diaz claims that Mayor Bloomberg fought against gay marriage in the state when he harbored presidential ambitions, but is now supporting the legislation for his mayoral re-election campaign.
He decided to appeal the order from the court that gay marriage was legal, and Mayor Bloomberg appealed that decision. And the judges of the appellate division in the state of New York sided with Mayor Bloomberg, and they decided that it's illegal. So I'm not the one to blame. Now he needs the gay vote, and now he's supporting, but he was the one that killed it.
While vowing to vote no on the bill, Senator Diaz proposed that gay marriage advocates push for a referendum, though he cited a recent poll showing that a minority of state voters support gay marriage. Fay believes the sentiments are changing in his favor. He also pointed to a study by the city's comptroller showing that the state would gain $210 million annually through increased wedding activities if the bill passes. Ari Paul, FSRN, New York.
Now, the world financial crisis has hit emerging economies seriously, among them Brazil. Brazilian authorities are optimistic, predicting that their country will recover from the crisis before most of the world economic powers. And Brazil's central bank only expects GDP to fall by 1% in 2009. But times are still tough for the average Brazilian worker. Wages for scrap collectors have fallen by half in just 1 year. And while they've always lived close to the subsistence levels, scrap collectors are now struggling to cope with the economy. Natalia Viana has this story from Brazil's financial capital, São Paulo.
They are the biggest recycling force in Brazil. There are about 800,000 scrap collectors in the country. In some places, like Minas Gerais, they collect 90% of everything that is recycled. But since October, prices paid by the industry have slumped by 62% nationally, according to the National Movement of Collectors.
The kilo of iron got to 44 cents and now has gone down to 11 cents. The cardboard kilo was 42 cents and went down to 23 cents. and mixed papers are just not being bought anymore.
The problem started when the international economy slowed down. With less demands for exports, many firms cut the production. On top of that, the price of commodities such as plastic fell steeply in the international markets. In Brazil, the middlemen started pushing prices down since October last year amid protests from collectors. Today, they still face an income cut of about 50%. FSRN spoke with some of the scrap collectors. Valdir Packer has been a scrap collector for 7 years. He now works at the Corpel Cooperative in the center of São Paulo.
Today I earn about $150 to $200, but last year I got to earn $600 at one point.
Were you able to keep the same lifestyle?
No, because my wife started working and my 19-year-old daughter started working too. I never had to ask for food stamps before, and now I have to.
Not that their lives were ever easy. A collector per day carries between 400 and 500 kilos of scrap in the rickshaw. They start early in the morning to tour streets around the cooperative and often make 3 to 4 trips. Then, they still have to wash and separate each material collected. In São Paulo, many of them have lived on the streets. Many cooperatives are run by social services as a means to reintegrate them into society. Sérgio Luiz Longo lived in the streets for 15 years.
I could not stay in one place because other homeless people would beat me up and throw me out. After I overcame drug addiction, I found myself without beauty, an education or profession. I had nothing.
He was invited to join a cooperative by a social assistant 3 years ago and now is the administrative manager.
Now I feel like a regular citizen, something I never felt before. This cooperative made me what I am.
In São Paulo metropolitan area, the biggest in Brazil, only 1% of the materials are collected by the official services, while another 20% go through the hands of scrap collectors. That is a lot for an area with 18 million people. Now, São Paulo feels the impact of the crisis, too. The National Collectors Movement estimates that 10% of the waste, mainly papers, stopped being recycled. Elizabeth Greenberg, a researcher at Polis Institute.
We hear testimonies of collectors giving up, recyclable materials in estate buildings that had to be sent to landfills, reduction of people in cooperatives. So in environmental terms, it's a step backwards.
But what can be done to solve this situation? According to Sempre, an organization of businessmen that advocates recycling, companies cannot do much since the market is self-regulated. But Elizabeth Greenberg disagrees.
They have to work within the framework of fair trade logic. The right thing would be for them to make a movement to make the work less precarious for this workforce. They could, for instance, buy and stock up the material for now.
The National Movement of Collectors also urges cities to hire cooperatives, which they can do without bidding, due to a 2007 law. Today, less than 10% of Brazilian cities have official recycling services. But while none of that happens, scrap collectors have to deal with the crisis on their own. Sérgio Luiz and his co-workers are trying to find alternative sources of income.
We have a dream of opening up a second-hand store in front of the cooperative and selling items we find amid the materials we collect. Items like sculptures, canvas, old coins, things that the society values.
Natália Viana, Free Speech Radio News, São Paulo, Brasil.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogotá, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.